Accession number 10385, Rule 1.
Mr. Habberton, Rule 1, can you tell me when it was and how it was that you came to be in the Rifle Brigade, please?
Yes, I worked, after I left school, I worked in the North British Mercantile Insurance Company, and in my department was an ex-captain of the Rifle Brigade from the First World War. He was a very active man, anxious to recruit members into the territorial unit of the Rifle Brigade, and I went along with him and enrolled.
When was that, did you say?
1938, as far as I can remember. It was at the time they were forming the 2nd Battalion. I think it was 38. It might have been the beginning of 39. I'm not quite sure. But and several others, people I knew, also enrolled from the company. And I stayed in that regiment more or less throughout.
Whereabouts was this?
The headquarters, well, we were working in the city in Threadneedle Street, and our headquarters was at 130 Bunhill Row. It was had a direct hit, and there's a plaque on the wall now where it was. It's an office block. But so we were all, you know, in the city, and no problem going to drills or anything like that. That remained the headquarters. I think it was bombed in sometime during the war, but we were away from it then.
What was your training like as a territorial?
Well, I wouldn't think it was as quite on the lines of the enemy training, because it tended to be something like a club as much as a military unit. Our training was, I think, perfectly adequate for bearing in mind what equipment we had and so forth and so on. But we're talking of pre-war now, although it seemed a bit perhaps arduous to us. I don't think it was as stiff as things later on became.
What kind of weapons were you trained on?
Well, we had rifles. We had, I think, one Bren gun per platoon. We had, I think, grenades and things like that. I don't think at that time we had any mortars. We got those during the war. Our equipment was meagre, to say the least.
Did you expect a war to break out soon when
joined? Oh, yes. Without any question. There was no doubt in any of our minds about that. It was just a question of when.
So when Chamberlain made his declaration that we were at war, you weren't surprised?
Oh, no.
Were you dismayed?
No, we just accepted it. I think we thought we knew it was coming, and that was that.
What happened to you once war broke out?
Well, like the rest of them, I reported to Bunhill Row on September the 1st. I remember that date because it was 2 days before we were officially called out. And we spent, I think, a month or so kicking our heels, more or less, in the city at Bunhill Row. We went on the ranges once or twice at Purfleet. Then we were moved out to, I think it was headquarters of Coastal Command at Northwood, which I think is still there.
Where's Northwood?
Northwood is in the Harrow area, North London. And what we were doing there was their guard duties. They were all RAF people, and we, as soldiers, were responsible for the sentry duty and so forth. After that, we moved and did a similar sort of operation at Northolt Aerodrome. on guard duties. Then we went to Beckenham, which is in London. We were there during most of that very hard winter, 1939, at Beckenham.
Beckenham in Kent.
Pardon?
Beckenham in Kent.
That's right, a suburb of Beckenham. And what we were doing there was training. I can't remember too much about it all, except that it was a very hard winter and it was all new. And people around there were very good to us. We were treated like friends. It was all very civilised. And then after that, we moved on from place to place all over them. The country. A lot of the time we spent in Yorkshire, where we did most of our serious training, right up until D-Day, when we went to Normandy, not on D-Day, a few days afterwards.
So you were in the United Kingdom right from
right through. My regiment never went to the Middle East. We did have a rifle brigade regiment that went to the Middle East, and in 1942 we all had embarkation leave. I think this is important. We were at Thetford at the time in Norfolk, and we got a fortnight's leave, and we were re-kitted, and we were issued with vehicles with sand tyres and condensing equipment, and we were due to go to the Middle East. And then right at the last minute, after we'd all had embarkation leave, the whole thing was cancelled. We never learnt why, or at least they may have known at the high command, but we, as far as we were concerned, it was all off, it was cancelled. And so we remained in England, training, right up until June 1944.
How did you feel about being in England? Were you happy about it, or did you have any wish to go?
Well, I don't think we thought very much one way or the other, quite honestly. Some of the army, we had a regiment in the Middle East. We knew that we simply went wherever we were sent. If they wanted to put us in the Middle East or Burma, they'd send us, and that was that. Most of the army, in fact, was in this country, in terms of numbers. I don't really think we paid a lot of attention to that.
Did you ever have duties on the coastline waiting to repel a German invasion?
We did, yes, we did right at the beginning of the war in 1940. It was during the Blitz and what have you. It was in the summer of 1940. And in fact, we were involved in this. Nobody ever got to the bottom of this. There was a panic turnout. I think it was September, either the beginning of September or the end of August, sometime like that. And the training we were doing at Porthcawl was extremely tough. You know, it was serious sort of stuff. We were putting up barbed wire and generally sort of manning the place. Presumably that was our sector, against some proposed invasion. And as I say, this one particular night, the whole battalion was called out and had to stand to. Normally we stood to only at dawn and dusk, but we were stood to on full alert for the whole night. And the general feeling at the time was that this was because the balloon had gone up, or was expected to go up there and then. And we'd be, presumably, doing what we could to repel invaders. But in the morning, the battalion was stood down, and we never heard any more about it. The whole thing just died out. But at the time, it was quite a major talking point. Whether the whole army round the coast was subject to the same thing or not, I don't know. I suspect they may well have been. But although we were in Wales, and nowhere near Dover or anything, we were still, called out on full alert. We did think at that time that to some extent it was a bit of a laugh because we were by no means well equipped in terms of weaponry. We had one Bren gun per platoon, which isn't very much, and rifles and other things. And we sort of had this vision of hordes and hordes of highly trained, efficient German soldiers careering about the place. But in the event, of course, it didn't happen. But at that time, we knew that if they had come, we didn't fancy our chances very much. We'd do what we could. But in terms of equipment and that type of thing, we realised that we didn't have very much to play with.
But you did have a rifle each.
Oh yes, we had a rifle. But as far as more formidable things, we were quite convinced that they had a good deal of, pretty good stuff in the way of weaponry. It wasn't a personal affair, it was entirely a matter of what you had to fight with.
Now, can you tell me about the preparations which you were personally involved in for going to Normandy?
Yes, come back to memory. We were moved from Yorkshire to Aldershot some time before the invasion, and we spent the whole time waterproofing all our vehicles, because by that time we had plenty of equipment and we were motorised as part of an armoured division. So we were no longer foot infantry, we were a motor battalion, and it was quite hard going putting all this Bostik everywhere, so that the tanks, vehicles, Bren carriers, trucks, no matter what they were, could drive off into the water.
What is Bostik?
Pardon?
What is Bostik?
Well, it's still on sale. It's a gooey black substance which is used now as waterproofing for joints and pipes and things. And we had to put this stuff everywhere that water could penetrate so that if the vehicle was driven off, it didn't immediately go to the bottom or something like that, or become full of water. That was quite a job, that. It took a long, long while. And that took most of our time before Normandy. See, we'd been well enough trained on manoeuvres and all that sort of thing long before then. And we're just talking now about the last stage, aren't we?
Yes.
And that was the waterproofing and getting everything ready for what we knew was going to come. We didn't know exactly when, but we knew it was going to come off.
So you realized you were going back into Europe?
Realised?
You realized that the army was going back into Europe?
Oh yes, no question about that. I think, I remember when we were up in Yorkshire, General Montgomery saw us all. He made a point of seeing his troops. A lot of other generals never did, but he did. And I always remember his first words when he addressed us. And he said, "Well, you've seen me now, and I've seen you, so we know each other." I can't remember what he said after that, though.
What kind of impression did he make?
Oh, quite good. We were rather confident in him. I certainly was, personally. I felt sorry when Montgomery was withdrawn from the Middle East. This was long before the invasion, and he was going to take over our army. I thought, well, they've lost a good chap there. I felt sorry for them. Although we were going to get him, I only say that because I know I was fully confident in him, and I think most of the other chaps were. We hadn't got any sort of doubts or worries in that respect. I think, in the event, not in connection with Montgomery, but in connection with the invasion itself, we were overconfident. No question about that. Because what we found out once things started was that we weren't up against a sort of semi-demoralized army with not too much equipment and all that sort of thing, but to our surprise, we were up against a very, very competent, tough, incredibly well-equipped army. That rather shook us all, because we didn't expect this, and that, I think, is overconfidence.
What had led you to expect them to be weaker?
Well, when I say weaker, we'd been reading all about massive bombardments. They'd had all the Russian trouble. They were short of oil. They had this, that, and the other. And in the event, quite a bit of their equipment was better than our own, particularly the tanks. And I think also the 88mm gun, which there was no equivalent of that. Things like that took us by surprise. We didn't expect it. I think this was a result of newspapers, propaganda, call it what you like. Because when I was at school, we firmly believed that the Germans had cardboard tanks, they had nothing much to eat and all that sort of thing. It just wasn't true. But we only discovered that much later on.
Let's go back to the preparations. You talked about bosticking the vehicles. What else were you doing?
Well, not a great deal else, because that was a pretty full-time job. And I mean, I was a wireless operator. That was my function in a Bren gun carrier. And as far as I can remember, much of my time was spent fitting the radio up properly, the wires, leads, all sorts of things like that. And it doesn't sound a lot, but one way or another, it took up most of our time.
What happened to you next, then?
Pardon?
What happened to you next?
When we went across.
What was the next stage in your preparations for going across?
Well, we did that, and after completion, I can't remember all that clearly, one thing goes on to another, but D-Day happened pretty soon after that. And by that time, I think the next day, we were already on our way to Tilbury. And we embarked from there.
In what?
Goodness, I don't know, just a ship of some sort. I couldn't tell you what sort of ship it was, honestly. I was lucky enough, or quick enough, to collar myself a hammock inside the thing somewhere, so I had somewhere to reasonably civilized to sleep, but that was sheer pot luck or speed of, well, I just don't know what. I don't think it was a what they call an LCT landing craft. It was a ship of some sort, you know, a proper ship with a deck and all that kind of thing. We had I think our vehicles were on it. Even that I can't remember. Whether they went across separately, I have no idea. I can't remember.
Which units were aboard the ship?
Well, our own unit was aboard it, but whether that would be some 500 plus men and officers, whether there were any other units, I honestly can't tell you. You know, we had a somewhat self-contained existence on this ship because it was pretty crowded, so obviously, you know, you kept within your own allocated space. So I can't really tell you whether there are any other regiments on it or not. I just don't know, because we didn't go from the ship into action. We drove off, and then after we landed, we drove to some orchard and spent 2 or 3 days messing about, not de-waterproofing, but taking a lot of the stuff off the vehicles that we had to put on, and, you know, the opposite sort of thing to what we were doing at Aldershot.
So, how many days after D-Day did you land in Normandy?
It was probably about a week, I think.
And whereabouts did you land?
I think it was a place somewhere near Arromanches, I think. I can't remember the name of the beach, whether it was Gold or Juno or what it was. You see, you weren't always aware of what place you were in. This was fairly normal. I mean, I didn't have a map at my disposal, and whether, I dare say, people in charge knew where they were, but as far as I can recollect, it was Arromanches. It wasn't at a harbour. We drove onto the beach, but there was no firing when we landed, although I remember we were waiting alongside the King George V battleship at one stage, and that was firing, and it was firing shells way inland. The whole thing was a tremendous spectacle.
Even a week after D-Day?
Yeah. But it was a tremendous spectacle. There were hordes and hordes of ships everywhere. There were naval ships like this battleship King George V, belting away with heavy guns, firing somewhere behind the lines, not at the coast. And I also remember silly things. We were looking over the deck, and there were hordes and hordes of jellyfishes in the sea. We could see quite clearly. And then we spent about half an hour just looking fascinated at these things. While all this was going on, we had nothing else to do.
So you weren't all nervous?
Not at that stage, no, because nothing was actually, you know, coming our way. So, and we were also supremely confident. But there's no doubt about that. We were quite sort of, we are the masters now, sort of without putting it into words, that's how we felt.
What rank did you hold at the time?
At the time, I was a rifleman.
And did you finish the war as a rifleman?
I did. I had grown to the rank of corporal earlier on, but I had that taken away for being drunk in charge of a motorbike up in Yorkshire. And that was that. But I don't think, wouldn't worry too much about things like that. Being a wireless operator was quite an interesting job. And
we'll say more about your wireless operating later.
Okay.
When you landed on the beach, was it a shingle beach or a sandy beach or what?
Oh, my godfathers. I've got a feeling it was sand. We just drove off. In fact, for all our waterproofing, it didn't mean a thing because we drove off on the dry sand. But that, again, I think, was sheer pot luck. Some people weren't so lucky.
So did the disembarkation go smoothly?
Oh, yes.
And were you told where you were going to go to, or what you were to do once you landed?
No, we stayed in our carrier and followed the convoy, which was directed by military police. They were everywhere. And we just drove until we reached this orchard. And we remained there for about a week or so.
How far from the front line was this orchard, do you think?
Well, I don't know where the front line was at that stage. It wasn't all that far away because there wasn't much room. I think the whole thing was only about 4 or 5 miles from the beach to the front line, if it was that. It was quite small, the area at the time. And in fact, when we learned, you know, where we were and all that, we looked at this little tiny blob on the map. I thought, well, crikey, we've got the whole of Europe now and we're only that big. You know what I mean? I wonder how we're going to get out of this lot.
Was the whole area swarming with British troops?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There was absolutely packed with men. I mean, there were vehicles, men, equipment, everything, because there were so many men in a small area. I mean, we were an armoured division. Well, that's an enormous number of vehicles and tanks and things like that on its own, and there were others as well, all sort of milling around in this quite tight area.
And were you getting raids from the German Air Force?
No. We never saw a German aeroplane. There again, that added to our confidence. All that lot, well, just dismiss them. We know the RAF can keep them out of the way. We were extremely confident.
What happened once you got to the orchard?
Well, there we just remained. How can I put it? What was happening was almost identical to the sort of thing that we had trained in Yorkshire for. In fact, even after the first battle, we used to talk about this scheme, because when we went on the training exercise, they were always called schemes. And we used to talk to each other and say, well, when this scheme's over, and so forth, because it seemed to us the type of country, the sort of things that we did and were happening, were just identical to how we'd been trained, except that in battle it was real. But I mean,